Harry poked her head around the door.
Viscount Faversham, what are you doing sneaking in to dinner early? This young woman has to eat now because I require her services later, but you, dear boy, will just have to wait until supper is announced after the performance. Oh, I say, Lady Crozier, you are a spoilsport. Here I am, dying of starvation, and just when I was getting to know this lovely girl. This lovely girl needs peace and quiet to eat.
Mary took his arm. She gave me a little smile. Don't believe anything this one tells you, she said. Giles Waverley gave me a hopeful smile.
I shall see you later, shall I not?
Maybe, I said. But once the Queen arrives, I shall be at her beck and call, with not much free time.
We'll jolly well make time, he said.
Out, Mary said. The poor girl needs to eat before our little surprise.
And she ushered him out. I could hardly swallow a morsel. Viscount Faversham, not only my cousin, but a viscount. Of course, I thought. My grandfather's brother had inherited the earldom. I'd heard all about the Earl of Altrincham and the estate at Kingsbury with its herd of deer. My grandfather had been sent out to the colonies, as always seems to happen to younger sons. My father had been born in India, spent his childhood in England, where he attended Eton and Oxford, as was proper for a young man, then sent back to India after his education with a commission in the Bengal Lancers. What a strange world we live in. An accident of birth order, making the difference between plenty and pauper. Anyway, I found I was excited to have met him. Rather stunned that I was at a party and the son of an earl was actually interested in me. I wondered if I would have a chance to see him again after our tableau. Then I had to remind myself sternly that I was Helen Barton, undercook. I did not move in the same social circles as a viscount, and I did not possess the wardrobe to move in those circles, even if I could escape my duties from time to time. Do not get ideas above your station, was something all young girls were told. But it didn't hurt to dream, did it?
Chapter 17. As soon as I had finished eating, Mary whisked me up to a bedroom where a maid was waiting to help me into a costume.
Formidable, the maid exclaimed when she saw me.
Her hair, it is perfect. Where did you find her? Monsieur le Marquis will be so happy to have his Nell Gwyn.
In the hotel gardens, Mary said. I still can't believe my luck at bumping into her. Here, Helen, try on your dress. As the maid removed my dress, she made tut-tutting noises.
Mademoiselle does not wear a corset.
She's a young girl. She doesn't need one yet, Mary said. Look at her neat little waist.
One must train the body early before the waist starts to spread.
She helped me step into the dress, lacing the front rather too tightly, I felt. As I saw myself in the mirror, the result was truly amazing. A brilliant peacock blue fabric with big puffed sleeves and yards of skirts. What's more, it fitted me as if it had been made for me. As I examined it more critically, I realized that it was quite revealing at the front. Should it not have another hook or button here? I tried to indicate where it plunged between my breasts.
Of course not, Mary said. You're Nell Gwyn. You are selling your wares in Covent Garden.
Or was it the Strand? My dresser was nodding with approval.
That is good. She has nice, firm, round breasts. See how the costume highlights them? The men will not be able to take their eyes off her.
This made me feel a little uneasy. I had never attended a party like this. I knew that the Prince of Wales and various aristocrats were roués. Had I been lured here for more than a tableau, at a safe distance from the audience? Was I fair game the moment the show was over?
Surely not, I told myself. Mary Crozier seems like such a kind person. She surely would never let...
There, mademoiselle, the French maid said. Now on to the makeup and the hair, and the transformation will be complete. Sit yourself here before the mirror.
I sat at a sumptuous dressing table on a burgundy velvet stool. A cloth was placed over my dress to protect it, and the maid started on my hair. She wound and pinned until she had it piled high on the head, with a couple of tantalizing curls escaping down my cheeks and into my cleavage. She started applying face cream.
"You have good skin," she commented as she massaged the cream into my face and neck.
"You have not done much damage by exposing it too much to the sun,"
I laughed. "It's hard to find too much sun in London."
"The English, they do not understand," she went on as she applied rouge to my cheeks. "They come here and they stroll on the promenade d'anglaise with no parasol. They look sunburned like peasants."
My cheeks looked unnaturally red, and when she applied kohl to my eyelids and a crimson gash of lipstick, I had to say something.
"Is this not a little too bright?" "Of course not," Mary replied. "You will be on stage with bright lights, and you are a courtesan after all."
I was now feeling more and more uneasy and regretted coming to a party unchaperoned. If some lord wanted to take me into a back room, who might come to my defence? Then I told myself that Giles Waverley would. I did have an ally here. Mary led me through corridors that were clearly the servants' domain, and we came out into a dimly lit ballroom. Lines of chairs had been placed around a dais with a red velvet curtain hanging in front of it. Several other people were standing around talking. They were dressed for the period with long wigs and wide skirts.
"Here we are, my love," Mary called as we came closer. "You see, I have found you your Nell. Is she not perfect?"
A tall, dark man turned to us. Charles II, with long curls over his shoulders and a brocade frock coat.
"Bonsoir, Nell." He took my hand and kissed it. "She is perfect. You are a genius, chérie."
"Just remember that it is only acting, Francois," Mary said, giving his hand a little slap. "Do not let yourself be carried away with any fantasies."
"As if I could when I have you," he paused, then added, "watching me like a hawk."
And she laughed. They clearly had a good marriage that had been a love match. We were led around to the stage. I gasped when I saw what lengths Mary had gone to in creating the scene. A proper theatre set had been built to represent the streets of old London. On one side was a barrow full of fruit for sale. It felt terribly authentic. We were put in our places, the design apparently having been taken from a painting. I was given a basket of oranges to hold on one arm, and I had to stand holding out an orange to King Charles while his entourage watched. We took our appointed spots.
"I'll give you the cue when the audience is in place," Mary said.
King Charles winked at me, but it was an assuring wink.
"Just do not scratch your nose or sneeze," he whispered. "We must be like statues."
We heard the scrape of chairs as the partygoers came into the ballroom, animated conversations in French and English. Then we were given the signal. I held up my orange and planted my feet firmly. The curtain was drawn back. Bright lights shone on us, making me blink. There was a round of genuine applause from the audience. I wished the Marquis had not said anything about having to scratch my nose because it had now begun to itch. I forced myself to stay still, my arm unmoving as I held out the orange. I could hear ribald comments coming from the audience and pretended not to have heard them. The moment seemed to go on and on. How long can I hold up my arm? I wondered. Finally, Mary came on stage and asked the audience to thank us all for our magnificent performance.
"Is this not the best tableau we have seen this year?" she asked.
The lights went out. The curtain fell. I was escorted back to the dressing room where Mary's maid removed my makeup, took down my hair, and helped me back into my own dress.
"You should choose another fabric next time," she said. "Velvet is not suitable now that it's almost spring."
"I'm afraid this is the only evening dress I brought with me," I confessed. I remembered my guinea and, if necessary, my pay packet, out of which I had no expenses.
"Do you know of a good dressmaker? Not expensive."
"My mother. She is the best. I will give you her address. She lives in the old town."
Find some fabric you like and take it to her. Tell her that I sent you, and she will give you a good price.
I didn't like to ask if my meager savings would be anything like enough to pay a good dressmaker, minus the cost of fabric, of course. I nodded instead.
Wonderful, thank you.
I came out of the dressing room. There was no sign of Mary. I wondered whether I should rejoin the party or take this opportunity to slip away. I was tempted to see Giles Waverley one more time, and maybe have another glass of champagne. It had not chimed midnight. Cinderella was not yet ready to leave the ball and find herself back in the kitchen. As I emerged into the brightness of a large salon, I spotted Mary and Francois, still in his Charles costume, chatting with a portly man with his back to me.
"I'm so sorry you were too late, sir," Mary said in English. "If we'd known you were coming, naturally we would have waited."
"Small problem with the yacht," said the voice. "Delayed me. Most annoying. Still, it's all fixed now, and I'll move into my villa tomorrow. But I wish I'd had a chance to see you as my ancestor, dear boy. Actually, not my ancestor, but my forebear, right? I don't believe we Germans have Stuart blood. We are certainly not known for being parsimonious like the Scots."
And he laughed heartily. I ducked back rapidly behind a large potted plant. The Prince of Wales had come to the party.
"So I hear that Nell Gwyn was a luscious little wench," the prince said. "Anyone I know?"
"You may do. She's part of your mother's household," Mary said. "Let me go and find her and present her to you, although I'm afraid she is no longer wearing her costume."
"What? You mean no more oranges to squeeze?" He laughed again.
I looked around frantically for a way to escape. I retreated the way I had come. Through the open door, I spotted Mary's maid tidying up. Perhaps I could ask her how I could find the servant's entrance and escape that way. At that moment, I heard Mary's voice coming around the corner. I had no time to think. I ducked behind a Roman statue in a niche. Mary came towards me.
"Claudette, have you seen Miss Barton?" she asked in French.
"Not since I helped her out of her costume," she replied. "Drat and bother, I wonder where she can have got to."
Mary turned, looking worried, and then she stared straight at me.
"Oh, there you are. I've been looking everywhere. What are you doing?"
she asked, looking at me suspiciously.
"Are you hiding?"
There was nothing for it but confession.
"I was looking for a way to escape, if you want the truth. I saw the Prince of Wales had arrived, and I had a rather disturbing encounter with him once at the palace. He propositioned me."
"Oh, I see," she nodded. "Yes, that is awkward, isn't it? He's a naughty old devil. Can't keep his hands off beautiful women, so I take it you don't want to meet him again?"
"I'd really prefer not to."
She took my hand.
"Then I'll show you the way out. Come on."
She led me swiftly along the corridor through a small door and into a servant's hallway.
"That's the back door," she said. "You'll have to make your way around the house, but it is well lit."
"Thank you so much," I said, heaving a sigh of relief. "We women have to stick together against the deprivations of the male sex, don't we?"
She squeezed my hand.
"What will you tell the prince?"
"That I couldn't find you and you must have gone home, not feeling well."
Then her face fell.
"Oh dear, I'm afraid I committed a blunder by telling him you were part of the Queen's household. Let's hope he doesn't come searching for you there."
"I'm told he stays well away from his mother when he's at his villa, as she doesn't approve of his lifestyle," I said, "so I hope I can avoid him."
"If not, just turn him down," Mary said.
"A girl is entitled to say no and to choose her own suitors.
Tell him you are engaged to a jealous Russian count who loves fighting duels."
I had to laugh. "Mary, you are a card. Thank you."
"I must get back before they come looking for me," she said.
"Off you go, then.
We must meet again soon. Come for tea and we'll chat. I'd love that."
"That would be very nice," I said. "But as I said to Viscount Faversham, my time is not my own once the Queen arrives."
"We'll make it happen. We're such close neighbours, and I do crave English company."
She gave me a little kiss on the cheek and almost pushed me out through the door.
I made my way through the grounds, listening to music and laughter spilling out through open windows, reached the front gate and arrived back at the hotel without incident. "Well, Bella," I said to myself, "all those years at the Tillys' house when you dreamed of excitement, romance and a glamorous life, now you are living it." It still didn't seem real. Chapter 18. There was no sign of any of our cooks when I returned to the hotel. I presumed they must have fallen asleep. I went to my room, undressed, and opened my window. Down below me, the city twinkled with a carpet of lights. It was hard to tear myself away from that magical scene. "I'm really here," I whispered to myself. It wasn't a dream. Tonight had really happened. I lay in bed enjoying the cool scented night breeze wafting in. Images of the evening flashed through my head, Giles Waverley smiling at me, standing on the stage and hearing the applause. But then the prince saying, "What, you mean no more oranges to squeeze?" I might have been naive, but not so naive that I didn't get its true meaning. I just prayed he would stay away from his mother during his visit, and that I could manage to avoid him. But he had been told I was part of his mother's household. Would he come searching for me? I just prayed a more suitable candidate for his affections would turn up rapidly. I woke at first light to the sound of pigeons cooing on the balustrade outside my window. The sun was streaming in, and when I looked out of my window, I could see the Mediterranean Sea sparkling as if it was laced with 1,000 diamonds. I gave a deep sigh of satisfaction. Then I dressed and went to find breakfast. Mr. Angelo and the two other cooks were sitting at a long pinewood table eating breakfast. They did not look very happy.
"So you got home safely, young Helen?" Mr. Angelo asked. "I was worried about you. I felt guilty that I had to let you go unescorted."
"I was home really early, about 10 o'clock, I said. "I left right after my tableau."
"Good girl," he said. "I was worried."
"We've all heard what these Frenchmen are like," Mr. Williams said. "When Mr. Angelo told us where you'd gone, we didn't think he should have let you go."
"I'm really quite capable of taking care of myself, Mr. Williams," I said. "Besides, I was only part of the tableau. I had to get into costume and pose on a stage, that was all."
"Well, that's all right then," he admitted. "Help yourself to breakfast, and a lot of nourishment you'll get from it too," he sniffed derisively.
I looked at the long, thin loaves of bread, a dash of butter, one of jam, and jugs of coffee and milk.
"That's what they eat," Mr. Angelo said. "I tried to make that French Johnny understand. Where was breakfast? But this is what he was eating. No eggs, no bacon, no kidneys, just bread. It's a wonder they keep their strength up."
"It's all that wine they drink," Mr. Phelps said. "They are thoroughly pickled."
"So what is the plan for today?" I asked, cutting myself a large hunk of bread and helping myself liberally to butter and jam. "What would you like us to do?"
"Miss Barton, I'd like you to organise how we order in our supplies," Mr. Angelo said. "I'll write you a list for grocer, greengrocer, butcher and fishmonger, and you can translate it and find out what purveyors the French chefs use in their part of the kitchen. Then you can take the lists down to the shops and arrange for delivery. Tell them the hotel will be paying the bills."
"Very good, sir," I said. I finished my breakfast, actually enjoying the unfamiliar taste of coffee made with hot milk, then took the lists that Mr. Angelo had made. I went to find Chef Lupin in the kitchen. He was not there, but the one he had called Henri was busy at work making a pastry dish.
"What is that?" I asked, because he was stuffing puff pastry with a rich brown mixture.
"It is called tarte de blette," he said, "a specialty of our region."
"What are blette?" The word was unfamiliar to me.
"It is a green vegetable, like cabbage, only with long green curly leaves," he explained.
Then he held up a stalk for me.
"Is that Swiss chard?" I exclaimed. "Then it is a savoury tart."
"No, mademoiselle, it is for the dessert."
but charred. That must taste bitter.
Not at all. It is made with raisins and pine nuts and brown sugar, and when it is finished, I will save a small taste for you. You will see it tastes not at all bitter. Quite delicious, in fact.
I asked him then about ordering supplies. He told me to present my lists to the hotel manager and everything would be delivered. But then he added that Chef Le Pan liked to choose his own meats and fish and vegetables. He was very particular about the quality. Do you know where he shops for these supplies? He looked amused.
In the market, mademoiselle. Where else is everything brought in fresh that morning?
The market in the town?
Bien sûr, in the old part of town, near the waterfront. Take the tram down the hill and then turn to your left. But you should go early, all the best items are gone.
I thanked him and reported this back to Mr. Angelo. He told me to go and investigate what sort of things could be found in the market. Meanwhile, he would make out a list of supplies for the hotel to order. He said we had been told that we could use any basic items from the kitchen, so we would not need to be concerned about staples.
To go and take a look at that market, he said. But don't buy anything. I'm not too sure about quality.
And we don't want it to go bad before Her Majesty gets it.
I won't, sir, I said, unless I find something we'd like to experiment with first.
Good idea, he said and handed me some francs. But don't pay too much for anything. They'll try to cheat you because you're a foreigner.
Oh, surely not.
They are cutthroats and brigands here. Everyone says so.
And what's your purse?
I was smiling to myself as I set off. My father had travelled the world and had raised us with none of these prejudices. I was eager to experience life in another country for the first time, not just in the rarefied atmosphere of the hotel, but down in the town where the real people lived. I went upstairs to get my shawl, excited about this chance to explore Nice alone and about the new level of responsibility accorded to me. In the top drawer, I saw the scrap of paper with Claudette's mother's address on it. Claudette had said she lived in the old part of the city. Maybe I'd have a chance to find some fabric and take it to her, since Mr. Angelo could have no idea how long it would take me to make the journey to the market and back. I took my purse and set off with great expectations. The air was quite chilly at this hour, chillier than I had expected. I had to remind myself that even in this southern clime, it was only February. I wrapped my shawl tightly around my shoulders as I made for the trolley stop. I waited, but after there was no sign of any trolley for a long time, I started to walk. The city was still waking up. Milk wagons were delivering to doorsteps, gardeners were raking paths, women were hanging out washing, children were walking to school with satchels on their backs. From a bakery came the delicious smell of bread baking. The sound of a bell tolling floated towards me, and then I came to a church to see people filing in for mass. They were mostly women, dressed in black and wearing black headscarves tied under their chins. The bell echoed in the clear air above our heads, sounding so different from English churches where bells are rung in peals. I followed the tram tracks until I came to a broad open area at the seafront. To my right was an impressive square lined with pink buildings. Then came gardens with lawns and palm trees. At the water's edge, a long promenade stretched away as far as the eye could see, lined with more fine palm trees. A pavilion of some sort with an oriental dome jutted on a pier out over the water. Couples who could only be English by the look of them were taking their morning constitutional walk. It was all so civilised. I stopped at a booth selling tobacco and newspapers and bought some bright postcards. In truth, I had been feeling guilty that I had dashed off that letter to Louisa in such a brusque manner. She must have worried when I said that I was going abroad with no further explanation. Then I did as Henri told me and headed off to the left, where a hill crowned with a fortress rose up at the water's edge. At one point, a small river entered the sea, its banks lined with washerwomen, making such an interesting contrast to the opulence of that sparkling pavilion with its glass dome. Here was a different Nice of narrow alleyways, cooking smells laced with garlic, laundry hanging out of windows, donkeys piled high with sacks, and the not too savoury smell of drains. I had to be rather careful where I put my feet, as it was not very clean underfoot. I found myself glancing about as I negotiated narrow alleys, but eventually I found the market. At this early hour, it was bustling with activity. Women in brightly striped skirts and black fringed shawls haggled with stallkeepers and chatted loudly with neighbours in shrill voices. Dogs slunk around and barked at cats. The noise level was intense as the sound echoed from tall yellow painted houses with their green shutters. And at the fringes of the crowd lurked gypsy children and scruffy young men. I remembered Mr. Angelo's warning and clutched my purse firmly in front of me, hidden under my shawl as I entered the fray. The fruit and vegetable stalls were a dazzling mass of colour. Oranges and tomatoes that we rarely saw in England. Bright lemons and purple onions. Spiky artichokes I had only just learned about at the palace. Giant cloves of garlic. Wouldn't the Queen be horrified to see those? And shiny purple vegetables shaped like fat, bulging cucumbers. "What are they?" I asked the woman at the stall. She looked at me as if I was a visitor from the moon.
"Aubergine, mademoiselle. You have not tried them? They are very good. We make the ratatouille."
"And those?" I pointed to round, red and yellow vegetables that looked so shiny they seemed to be made of wax.
"The peppers?" she asked in amazement. "You do not eat peppers where you come from."
"I've never seen them before," I said.
"Then try," she urged. "And the aubergine too. They are delicious stuffed."
She shook her head as if I was a creature to be pitied. I bought one of each and one of the purple onions at her insistence and went on to the next stall. This one had an array of olives. Olives were a rare luxury in England. I had never tried them personally, but here was a whole stall with olives of varying colours and sizes. Fat green ones, slim black ones, some stuffed with something red, others with a white cheese, some in olive oil, some not. I told the stallkeeper that these were unfamiliar to me, and could he make me up a small sampling of the various offerings? He was a rotund old man, wearing a dirty striped apron, and he laughed at my request. But then he gave me a more generous portion than I deserved. When I went to pay, he waved away my coin.
"No need, mademoiselle. If you like them, you will be back."
I moved on to the stalls selling herbs, big baskets of lavender, rosemary, parsley, and other plants I couldn't identify. And then I came to the flower stalls, lingering by bunches of daffodils, freesias, jonquils, and many others I didn't recognise, breathing in the heady scents. There were branches of the fluffy yellow flowers that smelled heavenly. I resisted temptation and made my way to the meat stalls. I realised here I was out of my element. Hearts and lungs and livers I knew, tripe I hated. But what were those little round nuggets? Were those sweetbreads? And was that brain? And coxcombs? And what were the tiny birds? I decided that Mr. Angelo would have to make his own meat selections or have the hotel procure them for him. Closer to the waterfront, I came to the fish market. My nose led me to the rows of stalls there. I realised that here too, I was a complete novice. I knew what herring looked like and whitebait. I knew a hunk of cod when it was put in front of me, and shrimp and lobster. But what were those fish with wings? And heavens, was that an octopus? I had only seen a picture of one before. It looked terrifying and disgusting, its tentacles draped across the slab. How could anybody?
"Bonjour, Monsieur Gentoux," said a voice behind me. "I see you have a fine octopus for me today." "Saved it especially for you, Monsieur Lupin," the stallkeeper replied.
I spun around to see Chef Lupin standing there, his basket already full. He looked at me in surprise.
"Mademoiselle, you are up bright and early. I thought the English were late risers."
"Not the servants," I replied. "When I was a housemaid, I had to light the fires at 5. This hour is a luxury for me."
"You also buy your food at the market?" he asked.
"I came to see for myself," I said. "In England, the food is delivered to the palace."
"Then how does your chef choose the best cuts of meat?"
The freshest fish? He asked in horror. I suppose he trusts those businesses that have supplied the royal household for generations, I replied.
Oh, I forgot, he said in patronizing tones. In England, there is not much selection to be made. Always the mutton or the roast beef and the boiled potatoes on the dreary cabbage, eh? Me, I would not bother to be a chef if all I had to do was to put a roast in the oven.
May I ask why you are so hostile to all things English? I demanded, feeling that I should stop, but no longer able to. I understand that we have invaded your kitchen, and that must be upsetting to you.
I assure you that we have no control over that, neither have you, but this criticism and mocking of English food. What experience do you have of this? Have you ever been to England?
He was a little taken aback by my belligerence.
I have not, mademoiselle. I have never left the south of France, I regret to say. I have not even been to Paris.
He paused then, his swagger returning, and added, But I can only repeat what one hears and see how the English who come to stay here behave.
They demand the mutton and beef, and they want us to cook their vegetables until all the life goes out of them. So I assume all English like to eat this way.
You will be surprised, Monsieur le Chef, I said. Her Majesty's food is most complicated. Sometimes a dish will take three cooks all day to prepare. It has to look exciting as well as taste good.
Do you think her food tastes good? He asked.
I thought about this for a moment. I had not had a chance to taste much of what went up to the royal dining room, but I found myself saying,
Between ourselves, I think they use too many rich sauces. One never gets the true flavour of the meat or vegetable.
Her Majesty's favourite accompaniment to roast beef is a horseradish cream sauce that is so hot the meat must taste like paper. Most of the vegetables the Queen eats are made into purees, and her meat is often turned into ragouts and terrines. Some dishes mix too many flavours. The Queen loves butter and cream with everything. So bad for her. And I grinned. He nodded as if he understood.
So you have a palate that appreciates the taste of good ingredients?
I do.
And how did you develop this?
I must have inherited it from my father, who had lived well and appreciated fine food. I was apprenticed to a good cook who produced simple English fare. Pork chops, roast lamb, roast pheasant, chicken, sole, lobster. There was a sauce to accompany them, but it never overwhelmed the flavour of the meat or fish. He was nodding now.
You really wish to become a chef?
I would like to be in charge of my own kitchen someday, yes.
I think you may have a problem there, he said.
You don't think I'll be good enough? I asked coldly.
I don't think you will find a male sous-chef who will want to take orders from a woman.
Perhaps I shall employ an all-female kitchen, I replied. After all, who does all the cooking in private houses? Women know how to cook instinctively. Men must learn. He laughed heartily at this.
Very good, he said.
Then he grew serious again.
But you do not wish to marry. I thought all girls wanted a husband and a home and a family.
Maybe one day, I said. I looked at him defiantly. What about you? Are you married? He looked embarrassed.
Mademoiselle, I have a problem. I do not see how I can ask any girl to marry me. Who would want a husband who does not come home until midnight and who rises at dawn to go to the market? I am married to my profession. Monsieur Lupin, you wish me to wrap the octopus, the storekeeper interrupted. Please, mon ami.
Tell me, I said, how does one cook an octopus? It looks as if it would be slimy and rubbery.
And so it will be if one cooks it too long. Myself, I prefer to grill it in the Spanish style. The tentacles can be cut into rings or marinated and served whole, but always they must be cooked to the moment of perfection, so that when one bites into it, there is no resistance. You will try a piece when I serve it as an entree tonight.
Thank you. You are most kind, I said.
I'm not normally known for my kindness, he replied. You must be having a bad effect on me.
Our eyes met for a brief second. There was something in the way he looked at me that made me feel uneasy. as if some kind of subtle contact had been made, so I said quickly, I must not keep you from your commissions. You need to prepare the lunch menu.
I do, he said. Au revoir, mademoiselle chef. I will see you at the hotel. You and your fellows should dine with us tonight. I am making a bouillabaisse. You will sample the local cuisine.
Thank you. I look forward to tasting it and to learning new recipes if you are willing to share them.
Until later, mademoiselle.
He gave a little bow and pushed his way into the crowd. I found myself staring after him, my heart beating rather fast. Remember that the French are known for their flirtatious nature, I reminded myself. Chapter 19. After Chef Lupin had gone, I wandered into the section of the market that sold household goods and bric-a-brac and found a stall selling fabrics. These were fabrics for the common people, no silks or brocades amongst them, but I found a length of cotton weave that felt soft and pleasing to the touch. It was in a pretty bluish green that would go well with my hair and colouring, and it seemed extraordinarily cheap to me. I added a couple of yards of thin muslin lining, then I went off to find Claudette's mother. After many directions and pointings, I found her dwelling up a flight of stone steps ascending the castle hill. She greeted me cordially when I explained that her daughter had sent me, and I handed her the cloth. I found her extremely difficult to understand. Her local accent was so strong, and she lacked most of her teeth, but the gist I got was that the cloth was of inferior quality and she didn't know if she could make a decent dress out of it. I explained that I had very little money. She said she would try and took my measurements. I went away not feeling too hopeful. Had I wasted precious money on something that would be useless? But how was I to know? I had no experience in selecting fabric for my clothes. In fact, I had not had new clothes for many years. At least it would be better than nothing, and if it didn't last, as the old woman had suggested, I didn't really care. And if I liked the quality of the woman's work, I would splurge and spend some of my hard-earned wages on a new wardrobe. I reported back to Mr. Angelo, who tried a dish using the aubergine, peppers and onion, sautéing them together with the forbidden garlic and tomatoes, then declaring it to be quite interesting. After my description of the market, Mr. Angelo decided he would order his meat through the hotel just to be on the safe side.
I know what I like, he said.
I also told him that we had been invited to join the French chefs at their dinner that evening. He thought it was quite neighbourly of them. I wasn't so sure. I suspected it was Chef Lupin's way of saying, look what we can do, a way of scoring points over the stupid English. We got down to work, discussing what meals we should prepare for Her Majesty's arrival.
She will have been travelling for 2 days and be tired, Mr. Williams said. A light meal, easily digestible. Maybe a souffle, a fish dish, a roast capon.
I think she'll be starving, Mr. Angelo disagreed. There is no proper food served on the train, no dining car. They have to take it on at stations and keep it hot for her. I think we should tempt her appetite, make her glad she's arrived, give her some of her old favourites. We know she likes cream of rice soup and white bait and lamb cutlets, and we'll order ices from the hotel confectioner. What else do you think?
As undercook, I kept silent while the men added dishes, but Mr. Angelo turned to me.
And for her puddings?
I thought carefully before I answered.
She loves her rice puddings and her meal brie, doesn't she?
I suggested, using the term the Queen always used for a German nursery custard. All those puddings with milk and cream. Maybe I'll make a cold rice pudding and custard tarts?
Good idea. Settle the stomach after the journey, Mr. Phelps said. If her stomach is anything like mine after all those hours on a train, she wouldn't want stodge.
I volunteered to go down to the market to purchase fresh whitebait the day of the Queen's arrival. Mr. Angelo cooked a couple of capons to serve cold with a Veronique sauce and grapes. And at dinner that night, we joined the French chefs eating at the kitchen tables. I have to admit it, the bouillabaisse was one of the most delicious things I had ever tasted. The rich broth, tasting of both fish and tomato.
and with a spicy tang to it, and the little pieces of fish and seafood coming unexpectedly onto the spoon, and the crusty bread to dip into it. Heaven. How do you prepare the sauce? I asked. When I found out they started with 12 cloves of garlic, Mr. Angelo shook his head.
The Queen wouldn't approve, would she? Nothing that would make her breath smell bad, he said. You know she's always forbidden garlic.
How would she know? Chef Le Pan asked.
If garlic is cooked well, it does not come on the breath.
Then he came over to me.
And I saved you a morsel of the octopus, he said.
He stuck his fork into what looked like a piece of brown grilled meat and held it up to my mouth as one feeds a child. The gesture was somehow so intimate that it startled me. I opened my mouth obediently and felt the explosion of flavor. Saffron and garlic and a hint of spiciness and flesh so tender it almost melted. He nodded with satisfaction as he watched my face.
Someday I will teach you to cook octopus like that, he said.
I also found that Chef Henri had saved me a sliver of the charred tart. It was delicious, and one would never know that it had a vegetable in it. After dinner, I went straight to my room and wrote down the recipe as well as I could remember it. Also the recipe for the fish soup. I had been keeping my own little notebook of dishes I liked. Dishes I remembered from the days of Mrs. Robbins and ideas that had come to me to try one day. Maybe I'll publish my own cookery book, I thought, laughing at this absurd suggestion. Then it struck me that this wasn't such an absurd idea. A book of recipes from the south of France. How many of those were there in England? I would try to assemble as many recipes as I could, starting with the bouillabaisse and that strange tart made of chard. That evening, I sat in my room, watching the lights of the town twinkling below me, and wrote one of the postcards to Louisa. My dearest sister, as you can see, I am in Nice. My employer decided to visit the Riviera for her health, and I was lucky enough to be taken to cook for her. Everything is so beautiful. Perhaps you will stop here on your way to Australia. Much love, your affectionate sister, Bella. The next day, work started in earnest. Her Majesty would arrive the next morning. Supplies were delivered, crates were unloaded, and our many moulds and saucepans were washed and placed on shelves. Mr. Angelo lamented spices and sauces that he hadn't thought to bring with him, also that he didn't have his stock pot.
"How can I possibly make decent food without good stock?" he asked. "I can simmer veal bones, chickens and vegetables all day, but they are a poor substitute for a stock pot that has been going for 20 years.
I was relieved to find that I was not expected to go down to the market for supplies every morning. Frankly, I would not have known what was good and fresh and what wasn't, especially when I didn't recognize half of it. I had come to realize that my training had only just started. If I couldn't identify every cut of meat, every fish, every vegetable, I could never call myself a chef. Maybe one day when Chef Le Pan had a little time, I could accompany him to the market and he could identify those mysterious morsels that lay on meat and fish trays. And I have to confess that the thought of spending time with him was quite a heady one.
Be sensible, Bella, I warned myself. There is no point in falling for an older Frenchman, especially when you are only here for a little while.
I assumed that Mr. Roland would come out to take my place as soon as he could walk again, and I'd be sent home. And I realized I really didn't want to leave. I'd just have to prove my worth. That was a frightening thought. I had seen the quality and intricacy of Mr. Roland's pastry creations, and I was nowhere near that level yet. But perhaps I could learn some local cakes and pastries to surprise the Queen. I had heard she did not like to be surprised. I went to work earnestly that day, knowing that the Queen would probably be expecting her usual tea time every day. I made a batch of sweet biscuits, a German recipe she liked that I had made before. Then I decided to make a coffee gâteau. I needed to ask Chef Le Pan for coffee and chocolate powder, but it came out as light and moist as I had hoped. I sliced the layers and spread the coffee buttercream and whipped cream between them. I was in the process of frosting it and wondering what kinds of decorations I'd find in the kitchen when I turned to see someone standing behind me. It was Chef Le Pan.
I congratulate, he said in accented English, then added in French. Most attractive and pleasing to the eye.
Thank you, chef. I only hope it tastes as good as it looks.
I am sure it will, he replied. I am impressed.
Again, I was left feeling uneasy. When he said, pleasing to the eye, his gaze had left the dish on the table and travelled over me. Surely I was reading too much into this, allowing my fantasy to run away with me. The morning of the Queen's arrival, we were up early. Her train was expected at the station at 11, and she, with her party, would be at the hotel in time for luncheon. We had been handed the official list of personnel. It was quite daunting. All in all, there would be around 40 people accompanying her. Two of her daughters, Princess Beatrice and Princess Helena, plus Beatrice's four small children. Also a young cousin from Germany, Princess Sophie of Mecklenburg, and Sophie's fiancé, Count Wilhelm of Schlossberg-Hohenheim. One rank down from this were the ladies in waiting, the gentlemen at arms, the Queen's secretary, her doctor, her personal maid, other maids, footmen, a guard of Highland pipers, and Abdul Karim, the Munshi. I studied this. So the Indian had triumphed after all. Those men with power and influence had not stopped him from accompanying the Queen. I had to smile when I looked over the list. How could anyone believe that she was a mere Lady Balmoral when half of the English court was here with her, including a guard of Scotsmen in kilts? Early that morning, I went down to the market to buy the whitebait. I didn't spot Chef Lupin this time. I have to confess that I felt a twinge of disappointment about this. I wanted him to approve that I was following his example. I caught the trolley back up the hill with no problem, then set to work on my desserts. I made my rice pudding with slivers of almond, raisins, and plenty of cream. I made the pastry and the egg custard. By 11 o'clock, all was prepared. The lamb cutlets waited to be grilled, the garnishes ready, sliced beside their pots, the capons boned and lying on their platters. So all we could do was wait. We put on our best uniforms and went outside to join the welcome party, as was expected of us. Hotel employees were also lining up, including the manager, looking very smart in his long frock coat, wing collar and top hat. The sun became rather warm as we stood waiting. I saw that crowds were starting to gather outside the hotel grounds. Some carried Union Jacks. At 11:30, the first of the wagons arrived, bringing the Queen's furniture from the train.
"Blimey, would you look at that?" Jimmy whispered into my ear. "She's brought that ruddy great bed with her. And a wardrobe. Does she think the Frenchies don't have beds or something?"
Then he grinned.
"Perhaps she thinks French beds have fleas or bedbugs."
He was becoming rather too cheeky, I thought.
"You should watch what you say, or you'll find yourself in trouble with Mr. Angelo," I muttered to him.
"I'm only saying it to you, Helen," he answered. "We young'uns have to stick together, don't we?"
I could have pointed out that I was a fully-fledged undercook and he was only an apprentice, but I didn't. One should never make enemies where one might need allies. Men from the hotel went to join the footmen who had come on the wagons, and it was rather painful to watch as they tried to manipulate the Queen's heavy bed and wardrobe down from the vehicle and in through the carriage entrance. There was much grumbling and cursing in French. I wondered if they would fit into the lift or if the furniture would have to be carried up a flight of stairs. More wagons pulled up, this time with maids accompanying the baggage. Crates were unloaded and carried inside, but still no sign of the royal party. The servants came over to greet us when they saw us standing there.
"Consider yourselves lucky that you didn't have to accompany her," a footman said. "It was an awful journey. That sea crossing, I thought we were going to go down and I was going to die." "So where is the Queen now?" Mr. Angelo asked.
"She's getting an official reception at the train station," one of the maids said. "She wanted to travel incognito and not be recognised, but there was a band playing and the mayor and the town officials standing to attention and young women with arms full of flowers when the train pulled up. Silly old thing. She insists on travelling by her own private train. How can she not be recognised?"
Hush, Maisie. It's not for you to comment on your betters,
a senior footman reprimanded and got a grin in return. Maisie glanced around. Well, I'd better go in and start unpacking her things. She'll want it to look like home by the time she gets here. And I'm ready to take a nap. I didn't sleep a wink sitting up crammed 8 of us to the compartment. One by one, the items of furniture, her rugs, and the crates were all carried into the hotel. The maids and footmen returned to stand in line with us. A carriage arrived, but it was gentlemen of her household. They looked a little the worse for wear after their journey, as if they too hadn't slept last night. They did not join us, but went inside. I thought I heard distant cheering. The sound of bagpipes floated up the hill on the breeze, and then we caught sight of them. First came the pipers, striding ahead of the royal carriage. The crowd outside the gates was now considerable. They cheered. Vive la reine anglaise, came the chant towards us, and the carriage came to a halt outside the main entrance of the hotel. In it was the queen, her two daughters and her grandchildren looking very sweet. Attendants rushed forward to open the door and assist her down, but a second carriage had already arrived. It held the Queen's doctor, Sir James Reed, and the Munshi, Abdul Karim.
It's that damn Munshi, I heard Mr. Angelo mutter beside me. He certainly considers himself important these days. No wonder the Queen's gentlemen have had enough of him.
More carriages pulled up, one with the Queen's ladies in waiting, and another with more gentlemen of the household, her secretaries, gentlemen at arms, and whatever these strange positions were called. I watched with interest. So the Queen's gentlemen, who were aristocrats, had to travel together in a carriage, while the Indian had a carriage almost to himself following the Queen. I was sure that did not go down well in palace circles. The Munshi jumped down and sprinted to the royal carriage to push the hotel attendants out of the way, prepared to help the Queen descend. The hotel manager stepped forward, carrying a huge bouquet of spring flowers.
"Welcome, Your Majesty," he said in hesitant English. "A thousand welcomes. Your hotel has been built for you and now awaits you with joy."
Queen Victoria gave him a little nod while examining the hotel with a critical eye.
"It's very large, isn't it?" she said.
"And please don't address me as Your Majesty. Simple Lady Balmoral will do. I wish my stay on the Riviera to be that of an ordinary woman enjoying the sunshine."
"Where is the entrance for Her Majesty?" Princess Beatrice asked in French as the Queen prepared to step down.
"I understood she was to have a private entrance. She is not able to walk far, you know."
"Of course. 1,000 pardons, Your Highness," the manager replied. "A special entrance, direct from the carriage, is to your left. I will lead you there."
So the royal party sat down again. The carriage followed him and came to a halt beside a special entrance crowned with a blue awning. The Munshi had walked beside the carriage and now helped the Queen to descend. She smiled up at him as she took his arm. Then inside she went, leaning on him and using her stick. The princesses followed, first Princess Helena, and following came Princess Beatrice, with her tow-headed children holding her hands and her older daughter and son following. I understood that Princess Beatrice had been staying with her mother since her husband, the well-liked Prince Henry of Battenberg, had died the previous year. After that, a second carriage drew up. A pretty young girl with almost white blonde hair braided around her head was riding in this one, along with a chubby man who looked around with distaste, as if this luxurious palace of a hotel did not measure up to his expectations.
"Who is that?" I whispered to the maid standing beside me. "Are they royal relatives?"
"I think she's Princess Sophie," the maid replied. "She's some kind of young cousin of Prince Albert's from Germany. She came to stay at the palace once. She was really nice, and the gentleman with her is her betrothed. They call him Willy. I don't know anything about him."
"She looks awfully young to be married, doesn't she?"
I whispered.
"I think she's 18.
I suppose that's a good age if you are royal," the maid replied, her voice a little louder now that the royals had gone into the hotel.
but you wouldn't catch me wanting to be tied down with a husband and children at least until I was 25. I want to see a bit of life first.
Quite right, I agreed, and found my thoughts going to my sister, Louisa, married at 17. What did she know of the world? Would she later come to regret that she had tied herself to this man and his family? I might be poor and have no connections, but at least I was free to choose my own destiny. This thought perked me up considerably as I made my way back to the kitchen to help with the luncheon. Chapter 20. The luncheon must have been well received because the dishes came back almost empty and there were no complaints, except for a visit from the lady of the bedchamber in charge of the royal children, giving us instructions on the nursery food. The children were to be served bread and milk for their tea, and their diet was to consist of nourishing soups and vegetables. Plain food, nothing spicy or foreign, we were told. Boiled eggs for breakfast and the occasional fish were also recommended. Jimmy was given this assignment.
"Cooking the nursery food?" he asked, making a face of despair. "How am I ever going to learn to be a proper chef if I have to make bread and milk? Even my old mum couldn't mess that one up, and she was the world's worst cook. It's a wonder any of us grew up without being poisoned."
"Then just make sure you create the best bread and milk ever made," Mr. Angelo said, smiling at Jimmy's horrified face. "And eggs boiled to perfection. That is a task at which most cooks fail."
Shortly after the lady had departed, we received another visitor, the despised Munshi in person. He swept into the kitchen with a swagger.
"Her Majesty has sent me to inform you that she wishes to give a little dinner party this evening, since the Prime Minister is staying nearby. Dinner for 12. Make sure it is an interesting menu."
"Our menus are always interesting," Mr. Angelo said, putting down the cleaver he had been using with a decided thump.
"I would not say so," the Munshi replied. "Again and again I request special food, knowing that my diet must be suitable for my religion. And what do I get? I get chicken with no flavor. I get a pea soup that you call a dal. And what am I to eat here, I ask myself?"
"The same as the other servants, I should imagine," Mr. Angelo said.
"You insult me. I am not a mere servant," the man said. "I shall report this to Her Majesty and have you dismissed."
Mr. Angelo smiled.
"I don't think so, mate. The one thing Her Majesty loves more than you is her food. I'm not going anywhere. You, however, should be careful if you want to stay around."
"What do you mean by that? Do you threaten me?" The man's eyes flashed.
"Not me," Mr. Angelo replied. "But I can tell you that you don't go down well with the rest of the court."
The Munshi gave a little snort of derision.
"As if I don't know this, but they are jealous that I am the Queen's favourite, and they can do nothing about it."
He stalked out of the room. The other cooks broke into chuckles.
"Blasted cheek," Mr. Angelo said. "We'll beat him at his own game. We'll make him a vegetable dish every meal and put so much spice into it that smoke will come out of his ears."
Then he clapped his hands. "Well, you heard the man. Dinner for 12. This didn't seem to worry Mr. Angelo one iota, but it sent me into a bit of a panic. Until now, I had looked upon this assignment as a lark, a challenge, a time to prove my worth. Now it struck me that I had to live up to expectations. A dinner party would not be satisfied with ices and rice puddings. I tried to think what Mr. Rowland would have done. At least an impressive gâteau. I thumped through the cookery books. Mille feuilles, cake à la chantilly. Yes, I could do that. I could always guarantee that pastry would turn out well. And oranges were abundant here. An orange cream served in orange shells? That seemed doable too. And for a third, I thought of a bread and butter pudding to remind them of home, but alas, we had no stale bread. This was one of the disadvantages of being in someone else's kitchen. So I decided I couldn't go wrong with profiteroles. Who doesn't like them?
Everything turned out to my satisfaction. I stacked the profiteroles into a tower and drizzled them with chocolate. Chef Lupin walked past and nodded. Mr. Angelo seemed to approve too, although he didn't say anything. The dinner party went smoothly. We were even sent a message of congratulations that the Queen found the whitebait to be particularly tasty and that Lord Salisbury had commented on the clever oranges. I was too worked up and too relieved to feel like eating anything at that moment and went out through the servants' door at the back of the hotel into the cool of the night. A great canopy of stars hung overhead, such as I had never seen since we left Hampstead Heath. A pall of smoke always hung over London. One never knew if there was a moon or not. I stood gazing at the stars, trying to remember constellations my father had shown me. Suddenly, I was aware of voices coming from directly above me. I looked up. A balcony ran around the rooms on the first floor, and several gentlemen were standing on this smoking. The scent of their tobacco wafted down to me.
"Doesn't she see he'll have to go?" said one of the voices.
I thought I recognised it as that of Lord Salisbury. It had that fruity, hearty quality of a politician used to speaking loudly in Parliament.
"He's an embarrassment, an utter disgrace."
I thought I recognised this voice too. I had definitely heard it before. There was a slight Scottish hint to it. Dr. Reed, the Queen's doctor, maybe?
"Claims his father was a Surgeon General in India. Why, the man was no more than a hospital orderly. This Munshie person is completely lower class. In his own country, he would be despised and shunned by polite society. And here she is, taking him everywhere with her. It's a complete embarrassment. We all threatened to resign, you know. It didn't faze her one bit. He has her bewitched, if you ask me."
"She always was influenced by a handsome male," a third voice pointed out. This one was higher in pitch and staccato in delivery.
"This man is not even handsome. Exotic at best, and thoroughly objectionable." "Not to her. With her, he puts on a different face, as sweet and charming as the Isis she so loves. What can we do to make her see that she is making a fool of herself and of her country?"
"I gather the local people here think he is some kind of captive Indian prince," the second man added.
"Gentlemen, I fear it is worse than you imagined."
This was Lord Salisbury again.
"He is not just an embarrassment, but a danger to our national security. You've heard of Rafuddin Ahmed? The barrister chap, the one who heads the Muslim Patriotic League."
"And what is that?" the third man asked.
"A group that's actively working against our nation, wants to drive the British out of his country, wants self-government for the colony."
"Good God, and this Munshie is connected with him?"
"He is. Great friends, in fact. We have information that the Munshie has been privy to top secret documents and has passed along their contents to the Muslim League person."
"Privy to top secret documents? How is that possible?"
"She allows him to stay in the room when she opens her dispatch boxes."
The voice sounded disparaging, and she's soft enough that who knows what she discusses with him or what he peeks at over her shoulder.
"That's a treasonable offence. The man is a damned foreign spy."
"So it would seem.
Has the Queen been told this?"
"She has, but refuses to believe that her dear Munshie would ever do such a thing."
"At least we can say we are safely away from the British court."
"On the contrary," Lord Salisbury said angrily, "I have received information that this Rafuddin Ahmed is on his way to Nice, if not already here, clearly planning to meet with the Munshie."
"But this must be stopped at all costs."
"I agree," Lord Salisbury said. "We will do what we can to make sure the two do not meet. I'm sure it can be arranged that our men intercept him and quietly escort him on his way. But if the Munshie still has access to secret documents, what is to stop him from communicating in writing to all and sundry?"
"The Queen must be made to see sense," the higher voice snapped out the words.
"And who will accomplish this?"
"Perhaps the Prince of Wales.
He dislikes and distrusts the man as much as we do. For all his philandering, he's a sensible chap and has our country's best interest at heart. He likes to stay well away from his mother when he's on the Riviera. She doesn't approve of his mistresses. Protocol demands that he comes to pay his respects. I'll have a chat with him and perhaps he can make her see.
It seems to me that there is an obvious solution, the higher voice said, this time speaking slowly and in measured tones.
And that would be to do away with the Munshi.
There was a nervous chuckle.
And how do you propose to do that?
There are all sorts of strange diseases down here, you know. The water is notoriously bad. Put something in his food, for God's sake.
You are not serious, surely.
Deadly serious. The man has to go. It's up to us to make that happen.
And how do you propose to bring this about?
You're a doctor. You must know what can kill a chap and how to make it look like food poisoning.
My dear man, I'm a doctor. I've taken an oath to preserve life, not end it.
Not when it is in the best interests of your client, of the public good.
Not even then. I'm sorry. I should go and see if the Queen needs me before she goes to bed. I heard a door shut above me.
He'll come around, the higher voice said. If not, we'll just have to find someone else. I waited for a while before I dared to move, but hearing no more voices, I crept back inside the servants' entrance and into the kitchen where the scullery maids were clearing away the last of the saucepans.
Sit down and eat, Mr. Williams called to me. You look worn out.
I pulled up a chair beside him and he ladled me a bowl of chicken soup made from the less desirable parts of the capons and the offcuts of the garnishes. It was just what I needed, slipping down without effort, and I gave him a graceful nod.
Rather strange, isn't it? He went on with his pleasing Welsh lilt. Being so far from home, everything's a bit different. A new kitchen, new challenges. It's no wonder we feel a bit topsy-turvy.
Then he gave me an encouraging smile.
I expect it will all work out. I think you're doing just fine.
I felt tears welling in my eyes. The yeoman cooks had hardly acknowledged my existence before this trip. Now he was not only keeping a fatherly eye on me, he was actually complimenting me. I made my escape as soon as it was polite to do so and went up to my room. Once I had safely closed the door behind me, I sank onto my bed. I tried to put the conversation I had overheard from my mind, but